Thank you. Okay. Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. I apologize for the delay. We were a little late in session, and so members, I think, are still getting their lunches. So for those who are here, I apologize, but I think members are, if they're not here now, they will be here shortly and maybe be eating at the table, the back table, while we, but listening carefully. So we do want to get started. Members, I just want to tell you that you all have your very own budget book for this division, which our staff has prepared for you, so it only has the sections that pertain to our budget division. And Senator Rummel recommends that you take the slip the cover page out and write your name on it, and that way you can, if you want to take notes or do anything or put slip any, thank you, any additional sheets in there, whatever. We'll hold on to your book and make sure that that's your book for the rest of the session. And this you will find, for those who are new to budget divisions, you'll find this very useful. This really gives you lots and lots of information that we're going to be going through as we do our budget hearings. So today on the agenda, we've got the Public Utilities Commission and the Commerce Department, the sections that we oversee, which are the Energy and Telecommunications Division. So we'll start with Dr. Burl Haar, who's here from the PUC. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. With me today is our Budget Director, Mary Jo Jasicki. I want to just give you kind of an overview of what the Commission does, some of the things we've been working on in recent year, and talk a bit about our structure of our budget and some of the budget challenges we're facing and some of the initiatives we have. Begin by talking a little bit about what the Commission does, an overview of the agency. Most simply, the Commission regulates three cornerstone retail service industries in Minnesota, like electricity, natural gas, and local telephone service. Provided some information here on ownership structure of those industries. And just to give you an idea of the size of those industries, the gross operating revenues of the companies that over which the Commission has jurisdiction. Not all of the utilities are rate-regulated by the Commission. Co-ops, for example, are not, municipal utilities are not rate-regulated, but they are subject to other provisions of regulation and do appear occasionally before the Commission. The statutory mission of the Commission is to ensure safe, adequate, and reliable services in these industries at fair and reasonable rates. And as of 2005, that mission grew to include the siting and routing of major electric or major energy facilities, namely generating plants, transmission lines, intrastate pipelines, be it natural gas or petroleum, and large wind energy conversion systems. The Commission is made up of five commissioners. They're appointed, I should say they're no more than three from one political party. They're appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. Your material should include, the handout should include a sort of an annual report. It's a very kind of condensed annual report. And that it does include a little more detailed information on our current commissioners and some of our activities in 2006. Independence and accountability, I like to think, sort of are the important characteristics of the commission. The commission is deliberately structured under statute to have a fair amount of independent decision-making authority. Also, because of that independence, the commission is likewise held to specific standards of conduct. Commission is subject to the open meeting law. All of its deliberations must be in a public forum before the parties. Decisions must be based on a record evidence and derived through due process, must be in written form, based in setting forth the rationale. Commission's decisions are subject to appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and there are other provisions that are designed to ensure the integrity of the decision-making process. Commission has somewhat of a unique role as far as state agencies are concerned. It really has sort of elements of all three branches of government. When the Commission resolves party-to-party disputes or sets specific rates or terms of service for utilities, like in a general rate case, really acting in a judicial fashion, it's quasi-judicial in nature. acts very much like a court, develops a record, has evidentiary hearings, witnesses are brought in, and parties are allowed to cross-examine. All rules of evidence apply, and the commission has to be based on that record. When the commission sets broad industry policies through rulemaking, it really acts like a legislative body. So it's the dynamics are different there. Because the commission has powers of investigation and does get involved in mediation of consumer complaints, it has elements of the administrative branch as well. I want to kind of shift gears and turn to factors affecting our operations as an agency. Cited four here that I think are the overriding factors that I would want to draw to your attention. We've had a sustained increase in filings and consumer contacts over the last several years. We've been, in terms of annual filings, we've come in right around 2,000 every year. I think in 2006 we were just a little under that. But it's been pretty consistently at that level for a number of years now. Also, our Consumer Affairs Office has had in the neighborhood of 18,000 contacts annually, ranging from complaints to just simple inquiries about where do I find information about this, you know, that kind of thing. The number of complaints has been around 2,600, 2,700, which is decreasing, I'm happy to report, and I think that's largely due to the fact that our folks have gotten out to try to educate community groups, consumer groups, about their options, what their rights are, and I think that's helped to bring that number down somewhat. Our workload has become more diverse and complex. As I said, the number of filings has really maintained a fairly high level. We've had, in 2006, we had some pretty significant rate cases. Xcel was in for an electric rate case, the first one in a number of years that was quite complicated, stemming actually from their merger several years ago. They were also in for a gas case. They offer both gas and electric. CenterPoint Energy, the major gas company in Minnesota, was in 2006 for a major rate case, and we've had others as well. We've had a number of resource plans that are significant undertakings. On the telephone side, there have been a number of major interconnection agreements that have worked their way through the process. This is where companies that are trying to provide services, for example, one company trying to provide services through Quest System, they have to establish an interconnection agreement, working out all of the details about how those services are going to be traded. A number of those were processed and decided upon this year. We've had some complaint cases that have been fairly involved. And, of course, as I mentioned here, the integration of the siting and routing activities. That's required some effort to integrate into the Commission's process a system that had been functioning in previously under the EQB, where the procedures and so on were somewhat different. And we've taken that, working with our colleagues at the Department of Commerce, to integrate that into the Commission system. We think that's working pretty well. There are things we need to continue to give attention to there, but we feel we're progressing very well there. But that has required a retooling on our staff level. We've had to reassign some of our existing energy staff to the siting and routing function because of the workload there. We also permanently reassigned one of our telephone analysts to energy to cover the load there. We've asked our telephone analysts to take up some energy cases to help us cover the energy workload. Energy is really where the majority of the more complex cases, I should say, are happening at this stage of the game. So we've had to rearrange our existing resources as best we can to try and make do with what we have. And I think we've done it successfully, but we're pressing the limits, quite honestly. Another factor that we've had to try to cover are the activities of the Midwest Independent System Operator. This is an organization created by FERC that regulates the transmission system affecting Minnesota, including Minnesota, but in the upper Midwest, actually all the way from Pennsylvania and Indiana and Ohio all the way to Montana and up through including Manitoba. So it's a huge footprint. And our system, our electrical system, is tied in with that. It's affected by that organization. So it's important that Minnesota's interests are adequately represented in that, in their activities. We have folks on our staff that are trying to do that. In addition to all of our other activities, the Department of Commerce is dealing with the same situation. So as I said, we've reassigned staff and tried to prioritize activities as best we can. But I think we've reached our limit. The amount of time some of our folks are able to spend on projects they feel they should be able to spend their time on is not what it should be, and we felt it was time to ask for more resources, and I'll be addressing that in just a minute. Another major factor affecting our operations are our electronic transparency and document management. Like the legislature, we're very paper intensive. We rely a lot on a lot of information, and we have worked hard over the last year, along with the Department of Commerce, to provide greater access to documentation through the internet. In July, jointly with the Department of Commerce, rolled out an electronic filing system that allows parties to file documents electronically and stakeholders to access documents electronically. And that's been very, very, very well received. And it's helped us to manage our information needs much more effectively. But we've only begun. We've really only begun. We're looking at enhancing that because there's so much more you can do with a system like this. And we want to take full advantage of those possibilities. And again, we're working with the department, and actually other agencies now are taking interest in this as well. Also, we've endeavored to try and update our hearing functions to take full advantage of what's available now electronically. We've given the commissioners laptops, they're able to access all the documents in a record on the laptop while they're sitting in a hearing room. And we are trying to do things to upgrade our hearing room so that other parties can see those documents while the commission is talking about, and that's one of the things that we're working on now. The final fact that I've missed it here is developing staff resources for the long term. We've had very little turnover at the Public Utilities Commission. We're lucky in that regard because we've had people that have developed considerable industry expertise over the years, and that institutional memory, that industry knowledge is very, very critical in our business. One of the things that you'll hear regulators often comment about is the so-called informational gap between industry and the regulators, just because the industry has all the facts and figures and they know their operations, and as we as regulators have to deal with a variety of other things, and there's always that gap. Sometimes it's great, sometimes it's not so great, but having experienced staff is very, very important in addressing that and keeping that gap to a minimum. And as I said, we feel very fortunate that we've had experienced staff for a number of years, but they're like me. Their hair is turning gray, and they're starting to look to other things. And some of them have already retired. We have two folks on the post-retirement option. They're working part-time, and when they go, I'm not sure what we're going to do. We're going to have to scramble to find resources on that. And I guess what I'm saying is we've asked for additional positions, professional positions, so we can start building that expertise. We can bring people on, get them started on the learning curve, and develop that expertise so we have qualified people to work on these cases as they come forward, because these are, as the gross operating revenues numbers indicated, these are big industries. They're critical industries for the state of Minnesota, and it's important that we get it right. The structure of the budget, the slide I'm showing you here is our budget, just one view of our budget anyway, without the change items that we're asking for. Total budget for 2008 and 09 is $12.6 million approximately. About 4.2 of that is for operations annually. Administrative hearings is in that. That's a revolving fund that we use to cover the costs of office administrative hearing expenses that we incur for evidentiary hearings that are that we have in conjunction with our major some of our major cases. Telephone assistance plan is a program that provides assistance. Actually, telephone credits, discounts for low-income people, so that low-income households can afford to have a telephone connection for local services. That's something we administer. That's a fund we administer. We really don't incur a great deal of costs ourselves, but we administer the program, the fund, I should say. And then the reliability administrator, reliability administrator funding here in our basic budget is $500,000 in 08 and zero in 09. And I should take a minute just to explain what that means. The $500,000 there is actually funding for a project through the Department of Administration for increasing energy efficiency in state buildings. And the reliability administrator funding is a temporary funding mechanism. It's a special fund that sunsets in June of this year. And part of the authority, the funding authority for the reliability administrator was used for that program. The $500,000, the admin program, ends in 08, and that's why it appears in 08 and does not appear in 09. And as I put in the note at the bottom, approximately 97% of our expenditures, our costs, are recovered through our assessment authority, so that and all those funds go back into the general fund. So we recover just about everything that we spent. Priorities for our priorities for budget use. Our commission's first and foremost responsibility is to make informed decisions, fair decisions. So our first priority is informed, timely, and clearly articulated decisions that are consistent with our statutory mission. Also, increasingly in recent years, the Commission has felt a need to become involved in regional and national forums on utility and telephone matters. I mentioned to you a minute ago about the Midwest ISO and the activities there. The Regional Oversight Committee for Quest has been an organization that's actually been active for a number of years. That too looks at is an organization of all the states in Quest service territory, and it reviews activities in various states, and is important for for Minnesota to be a part of and represented in. And there are others. There are. Our commissioners have been very active in national forums, National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners. Commissioner Copendreyer is active in the Nuclear Waste Strategy Coalition. Commissioner Rhea has been very active on renewable initiatives nationally and energy efficiency initiatives nationally. So those are all factors that we think are important and need to be incorporated in our budget proposal. Also, developing a user-friendly system for prompt and thorough resolution of consumer inquiries and complaints. That's a critical aspect because one part of our operation is mediation of consumer complaints. And our Consumer Affairs Office, as I said before, has been active in trying to increase its outreach to inform consumers about their rights. But we also have to have the ability to provide information to them readily, to track consumer complaints, to track cold weather activities, and that's been an issue in legislative sessions in the past, and we're working on systems to do that. Enhanced accessibility to information about consumer actions. This gets back to the electronic filing initiative I mentioned to you a minute ago, allowing stakeholders greater opportunity to see what's going on at the commission, to know what's coming up, to know where and when and how to have input when they feel it's in their best interest to do that. The electronic filing system has helped us immensely in that regard. But as I said, we've only sort of started the process there. There's a lot more potential there, and I'm very excited about the potential, but it's going to take effort to move forward with that. And then finally, stable and productive staff resources, and it gets back to the issue I was talking about, our staff resources and the need to develop for the longer term. The most pressing budget issues we face is, first of all, continuation of funding to support the siting and routing staff functions. As I mentioned to you, our siting and routing staff functions are currently funded under the Reliability Administrator funding mechanism. That was brought over from the Department of Commerce. That sunsets in June of this year. If that funding does not continue, the staff resources we have there will not be available to the commission, and it will be in serious trouble because we will have that workload, but no resources with which to address it. So that's our most pressing item. And that is included in one of the change items, which I'll mention in just a minute. Also, staff resources to manage the growing and more diverse work requirements and replenish staff expertise over the long term. The workload has become more complex. The world has changed tremendously. Telecom has gone through a complete transformation. Energy, particularly on electricity, is changing rapidly with the emergence of wholesale competition and markets in those industries, and the need for development of renewable resources and infrastructure upgrades and so on. It's picked up its pace tremendously, and it's changed tremendously over the last few years, and we need resources to manage that process. Information technology. We want to, as I said, go through and tap the full potential of what we believe we can do. We have largely been funding our work so far and the work we have on the table right now through our existing budget. We have had some salary savings over the years, and we've used that and earmarked that for the technology upgrades that we feel are important to keep us in the, you know, on pace with what's going on in the industry and in the world. And also, an important part of what we need to do is have access to independent sources of research on regulatory issues. And the National Regulatory Research Institute has been in existence for about 30 years, I believe. They have gone through a variety of funding mechanisms over the last several years, but their board has recommended and proposed to the states to ask the states to incorporate each state's share of their costs in the commission budgets, and that the commissions use their assessment authority to recover those costs. Now, currently, the way the National Regulatory Research Institute costs are being recovered in Minnesota, the NRI is billing the utilities directly, each utility directly. So they have to send out bills to each one of these companies. This would consolidate it in one place under the commission's budget. It would eliminate the need for all that multiple billing. And actually, under this revised program, Minnesota's share of NRI's dues actually drops. It actually goes down somewhat. So overall, the utilities would be paying less under this plan than they have been all along. So that's what that last item is about. The initiatives pretty much correspond to what I was just talking about. The siting and routing funding, what we're proposing to do is to incorporate into our general budget what we believe are mainly the staff costs for the siting and routing staff so we can continue to provide those services to the commissioners and carry out our functions in a timely fashion. There is some funding in there, additional funding for professional services for if studies need to be done, or so on. I think it's $190,000. for that. The second initiative, we are asking for two professional staff positions. These would be upper-level rate analyst or statistical analyst type positions. Could be an attorney position that where we need to plug that in to help us with this more complex and expanding workload. And then finally, the NRRI funding, which is $45,000, I believe, over the biennium. So that concludes my overview of the commission, what it does, and some of the challenges we're facing. So I'd be happy to answer questions if I can.
Senator Hahn, thank you very much. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Harp. In your mission, in the slide in your mission, you pointed out that the mission is to ensure safe, adequate, and reliable services at fair and reasonable rates. And I'm just wondering what role or what is going on right now to facilitate the development or the construction of additional power plants in Minnesota. I've talked to many people that as we look ahead and look at the power needs of the state and questioning whether we have adequate power plants online, and given that that process seems to take a fair amount of time to get accomplished, it would seem to me that there should be some discussion about this, what we're going to be doing to build additional power plants, and I don't know, is that something that your commission plays a role in, and if so, what role, and where are we, and why have we not had much conversation about that in the last few years?
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, thank you for the question. Yeah, the commission is pretty actively involved in those kinds of, you know, looking ahead at what the needs are. We actually have a integrated resource planning process the commission relies on, where the major utilities, the larger G&T cooperatives and so on a two-year cycle come in and present us with what they think their needs are going to be 15 years out, and then what their options are, what their supply options are to meet those needs on a 15, basically during that same time period. And that's something we do on a regular basis. I mentioned in my earlier comments that we had several major resource plan proceedings during 2006, and that's exactly what we look at. We look at basically what the generation needs are going to be for utility and its load. One of the things about Minnesota is that, and this is probably true of utilities in other states too, I'm sure it is, but in Minnesota, the major utilities all are unique. They all have sort of unique characteristics. We have Xcel, which is the largest. They provide service to the Twin Cities market elsewhere too, but that's their primary base. So that's a mix of residential, commercial, industrial. It's kind of balanced. Minnesota Power is a big share of their load is the taconite industry, so they're heavily industrial. Their load is large user group is a very significant, much larger than in most utilities. Otter Tail Power, for example, is more rural, smaller town, so it's a combination of residential and agricultural uses. So it's they're all different. They all have different circumstances, but we do take that into account in the resource planning process. And then also there is a separate transmission planning process where the utilities need to get together, also on a two-year cycle, and come in with a plan that outlines what they believe the transmission needs are, where there are problems, and you know what should be done to address those issues. So we have those two planning mechanisms that in place that I think are intended and do identify needs and can lead to proposals to address them.
Senator Fredrickson, did you have a question?
Yep. Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Haar, I have a couple questions about the Monticello nuclear plant. The first one is I believe that the PUC has approved storage casks.
Yes.
At the Monticello. And have those casks been utilized yet? And at what stage are they in utilizing?
Dr. Haar.
I would have to make inquiry on that. I don't know that right offhand. I mean, the approval was just granted not long ago. I'm not exactly sure where Xcel is with actually constructing that project at this point. I'd have to find out, and I can be happy to do that.
Commissioner Garvey is back there. Maybe he can help us. Do you want to get into that when you come up?
He's deferring, Madam Chair.
Okay, we can. That's fine.
And Madam Chair, that's a good question.
Senator Fredrickson.
Dr. Haar, currently it's my understanding the Monticello nuclear plant is shut down because of some safety concern or some mechanical breakdown. What is the status of the plant? And did the federal regulatory agency share with you what the deficiency was in the plant or what caused the shutdown?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, my understanding is the plant is running again. It's ramping up. The nuclear plant takes a while to re-engage, and it's in the it may be operating at full power now at this point. I don't know, but I know that it was operating as of earlier in this week. So it is back online. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is the agency that has primary responsibility for the circumstances at the safety and operational circumstances at the plant. They were very much involved in assessing that. As I understand, it was some sort of metal container that was attached to it. I don't know if it's a steel I-beam or some sort of steel contraption, and the wells gave loose, and this object dropped a short distance that interrupted some steam flow valves, and the system automatically shut down. Anytime there's a disruption like that, the system is designed to shut down. That's what happened. That's my non-nuclear physicist explanation. So take that for what it's worth. And my understanding is that that the NRC, as a result of this, did do a review of all of the nuclear plants in the United States that are the boiling water variety, like the Monticello plant. I mean, that's the design and the technology of Monticello is slightly different than Prairie Island. It's a slightly different technology, but the NRC did that review in all the other plants in the United States.
And Madam Chair, Dr. R, one final question. Do you know what stage the federal government is on Yucca Mountain, how long it would be until there is a storage facility there to which the spent nuclear rods can be shipped?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, I'll take a guess at it, but I don't know for a fact. That's obviously been a question a number of people, including us, have been wondering. But my understanding is 2017, 2018, somewhere in that range. Mr. Garvey may be able to give you something more accurate than that. But that's my understanding based on current projections.
Thank you.
There was a lawsuit brought by all the utilities against the federal government. Is that concluded, do you know, because of the Yucca Mountain kind of slowdown? Do you know?
I'm not sure of the status. I think that's concluded.
All right. We'll ask you that, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Other questions? Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks. Madam Chair, Mr. Haar. Could you talk a little bit about the PUC's process and involvement with the Big Stone 2 plant in South Dakota? Could you provide some background information on how PUC has been involved with that?
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator, the Big Stone plant is undergoing an upgrade in South Dakota. The plant upgrade itself, of course, is subject to the approval of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission, and they've had their own proceedings regarding that. The commission here, our commission, has been asked to review and approve a certificate of need for upgrades necessary to in the transmission lines carrying the power, some of the power from the Big Stone plant to the Twin Cities market, basically to the east. And that's been the nature of the commission's proceeding, is looking at the transmission needs associated with that plant. There have been extensive proceedings on that. It's been a somewhat controversial case, and controversial cases always take more time, involve parties, and they're more difficult. But that's basically what the commission has been involved with to date.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Senator Shetty.
The involvement that you described, how is that different from PUC's involvement in a plant that would be located in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Senator, if the plant had been located in Minnesota, there would have been a proceeding for the certificate of need for the plant itself, and also then a separate or probably parallel proceeding for the siting of the plant. That would have been one set of dockets, and then if there were transmission upgrades like the ones we are experiencing now, then that would have been a separate proceeding dealing with the need and the routing. And that's basically what we have going on in Minnesota right now. We have the need and routing approvals before the commission for the transmission lines, for the transmission segment.
And what is the how is that process going? What stage is that in?
Madam Chair, Senator, as I said, there have been extensive public hearings, evidentiary hearings on that. I don't have the exact schedule with me today, but I believe the matter is going to be scheduled sometime in the next few months for the commission. I can find that out. I just didn't bring my schedule with me. I don't remember exactly when. But I'd be happy to get that information for you.
Last question, if I may, Madam Chair. Has concern been expressed on the part of the PUC to the South Dakota PUC about its lack of involvement with the process of establishing Big Stone 2, particularly in regards to the environmental impact on Minnesota, which seems to be Minnesota seems to be enduring the primary environmental impact, but yet we don't seem to have a say in what happens.
Madam Chair, Senator, Commission has not formally taken a position on that. I mean, I guess our Commission's position is that that's the jurisdiction of the South Dakota Commission. There was some discussion early on about possibly having some joint hearings on some of the transmission-related issues, but the other states that were involved in that weren't interested in doing that.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Har, I know your second bullet here on most pressing budget problems deals with staff resources and replenishing staff expertise for the longer term. And I'm seeing that as a common thread and theme that when we talk to the DNR and the MPCA, they come up with some of those same problems. Is this something that's coming about right now? Has this been coming on in the long term or since the $4.5 billion budget deficit, or give us a little history on that?
Madam Chair, Senator, I could speak for the Commission. I'm not sure about the other agencies, but I'm not surprised to hear that it's an issue with other agencies. And I think I don't know if it's the baby boom generation or exactly what the phenomenon is here explaining it, but in our case, as I said, we've had very little turnover, and we've had very loyal and dedicated professional staff that have worked on these issues over the years. And they're reaching a point where they're getting ready to leave. They're thinking about retirement, and it's a serious problem. These are very complicated issues. They're more complicated than when I first started in this business, I can guarantee you. And I'm very concerned about where that's going to leave us when these people walk out the door. If you don't have very competent people there, ready to take over the reins and deal with these issues, I think that puts the regulatory agencies at a tremendous disadvantage. I just want to, skipped over something I meant to mention before, just to put in perspective. Our budget, as I said, is $4.2 million annually. Our operating budget is about $4.2 million annually. A few years ago, just to put it in perspective, comparing us to other states, a few years ago, the Michigan Public Service Commission did a study comparing state commissions on a budget and staff size basis, on a per capita basis. Minnesota came in 48th. That's pretty low. I mean, on the one hand, we're proud of the fact that we are able to get as much work done and do as much quality work as we have given that level of staffing. But on the other hand, you can see why we're feeling like we're being pressed kind of to the limits now. And even if you had doubled that to include our colleagues at the Department of Commerce, we would still be in the lowest 20%, and Minnesota is not in the lowest 20% in terms of population size. So that's, hopefully that's evidence that you can take into consideration.
Dr. Haar, you mentioned the you talked about the reliability administrator assessment, and I'm not quite clear on what's happening with that. First, you mentioned the green buildings piece that I think is done with admin.
Yes.
$100,000 or something. What's happening with that is that program going away?
Madam Chair, you're referring to the administration's program. I'm not sure about that. The funding is going away.
The reliability administrator assessment is scheduled to sunset. Is that why you're saying the funding's going away?
The funding for that. Yes, I mean, I guess the answer to that is yes. The answer to that is yes. The reason I'm balking is that the $500,000 came in under a separate provision in law, but it was tied back to the funding authority, the assessment authority for the reliability administrator. It came on under that cap, but it was money that was designated for that project. The program is the Department of Administration's program. We don't know what their plans are on that. We are the... Basically, we have the assessment authority. We do the assessment. The money goes to them.
So when you said you talked about, and then, you know, you talked about the sunset and the need for funding the staffing in that area, but are you asking to extend the sunset or just to have a different assessment?
Madam Chair, thank you for that question. I mean, extending the sunset would be one way of doing it. However, the current arrangement under the sunset is it's a special fund. It's a 200 fund, and that's treated a little differently. What we would prefer to do is to take what we feel we need to continue our staffing operations and the related activities, put that into our general fund budget, just our normal budget, and continue those operations as a general fund and just let the sunset occur.
And does it make a difference who will be paying in? Is the reliability is that assessment just Xcel, or is that all the utilities?
Madam Chair, that's everyone.
That's everyone. So it's really the same people who are paying either way?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. And so the Ken Wolf position, that still would remain under your plan as well as additional staff?
Madam Chair, the reliability administrator, which is currently occupied by Ken Wolf, the funding for that would continue. If we rolled it into our general fund, we would probably change sort of the description of that, make it into a supervisory position, because the reliability administrator has certain duties under that section of the law. And if that sunset, then those would go away. But we would carry over Mr. Wolf's current supervisory responsibilities along with the staff that he supervises presently.
Okay. All right, thank you. And then also I'm wondering, I know we're going to be talking about the Renewable Development Fund when we get to Commerce, because there's a lot of recommendations in that area.
Right.
Can you kind of remind us what your role is in administering that fund and maybe a little background on it?
Madam Chair, thank you. The Renewable Development Fund came about through legislation associated with Xcel's nuclear storage, and they, under that legislation, they are required to set aside $60 million annually in the Renewable Development Fund, and those funds are to be used for development of renewable energy for various projects. There is a separate governance body that's been established, made up of representatives of Xcel and various stakeholder groups. They are the ones that are really responsible for soliciting the proposals, reviewing the proposals, evaluating them, basically making most of the operational decisions. They have to present the final proposals to the commission. The commission then will sort of grant approval on their recommendation. But the governance body are the folks that really, you know, have front line responsibility for overseeing the activities of that fund. So the commission's role is somewhat limited, approval of the proposals that they bring forward.
Okay, so in terms of the funding history and all the things it's been used for, should I ask Commerce that rather than you?
I don't have that information,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Yep. All right. Any other questions at this point? Great. Well, thank you. And Ms., I forgot your name. Sorry. Where's my agenda? What's her name? Okay, Ms. Jessicki, I'm so sorry. I was looking for my agenda.
That's okay.
You know, is there anything you wanted to add? Or?
No, nothing.
All right. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Okay, that's smooth. Sure. All right, why don't we bring the Commerce Department people up? Deputy Commissioner Edward Garvey and Assistant Commissioner Mike Bull. Just you. Okay, just Edward Garvey. And members, you have a PowerPoint from Commerce as well. For those who got here later, I just want to remind you to put your name on the front of your budget books, and you can pull this sheet of paper out to do that. And we'll be keeping them in the committee because you should all have your own set of budget books in your office. So we want to keep them here when you leave so that they'll be here next time we come back.
So you can turn that off.
But, you know, feel free to – these are your books, so you can do whatever you want with them, you know, doodle, take thoughtful notes, whatever, anywhere in between. It's fine. And there was something else. Oh, in your budget book, let's see, we're on page 24.
25
of the Commerce section. So there's tabs for each agency. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Garvey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce for Energy and Telecommunications. You heard a very good briefing by Executive Secretary Burl Haar of the Public Utilities Commission. There's a very strong symbiotic bond between at least a large portion of my staff and the commission. I have about 70 full-time staff. About a third of them, half of them, provide public policy, public interest, utility analytical advice and advocacy to the Public Utilities Commission. We analyze every docket that is filed with the commission. We offer comment, advice, recommendation for their decision-making purposes. The remainder of the staff handles the low-income energy assistance program, the state's energy information office, and provides the provides advice and guidance and public policy to you as elected policymakers and, of course, the governor of the state of Minnesota. I'll very quickly walk through the handouts that I've given you. In many respects, as you sort of can tell, our purpose and the commission's purpose are one and the same.
to ensure that all Minnesotans have access to reliable, reasonably priced, efficient, economically sound, and environmentally responsible energy and telecommunication services. We do this by overseeing the state's electricity, natural gas, and telephone service providers, representing the public before the Public Utilities Commission, and promoting reliable, low-cost, and environmentally superior energy systems and energy conservation. The total aggregate budget that runs through my division is $230 million. Most of that is the low-income heating energy assistance program, LIHEAP. $25.6 million is from the State Energy Information Office. $32.7 million is our planning and advocacy. Those are the folks that provide guidance and recommendations to the commission on behalf of the public and the administration. And then 2.1 is for telecommunications, which similarly provides advice and guidance and policy recommendations to the commission as well as me and the governor of the state. Those are biennial numbers, of course. You see the expenditures, $15.8 million, $3.9 million general funds, special revenues, $9.1 million, $9 million each year, and then the bulk are from federal funds, primarily through the U.S. Department of Energy's LIHEAP program. I want to now move very quickly into some of the change items. The compensation items, this is one that's embedded into the governor's overarching budget that he announced earlier this week. And that basically will allow at least a portion of the compensation adjustment increases that staff receive on an annual basis. The more important, and I don't want to sort of not to belittle it, the compensation adjustment is one that I think you will be most interested in, as are the change items and the policy budget items, and those are listed under the energy and telecommunications slide. There are three of them specifically that I'd like to touch base with you on, but I want to also first put them in the larger context of the governor's Next Generation Energy Initiative. In December, the governor announced his Next Generation Energy Initiative. It had three components: promotion of more renewables, more energy efficiency, and less carbon. We've introduced a bill, Senate File 145, that, Madam Chairman, we are very appreciative that you are one of the co-authors of, that would codify many of the policy provisions of the governor's Next Generation Energy Initiative. Some of the action items of his initiative are budget items, and you see at least three of them before you in this setting. The E85 Everywhere budget item is a $12 million one-time grant to the Department of Commerce to provide grants to gas stations to offset a portion, roughly a third to a quarter, of the costs of installing an E85 pump. Currently, we have approximately 300 E85 pumps in the state of Minnesota. That's a nation-leading number in and of itself, but it's still a relatively small number when you think about the 4,000 or so gas stations we have. We think we can do more. We think we can and will do many more. We think we can and should do 1,500 more to get to a total of about 1,800, enough that everyone has access to E85 throughout the state to encourage them to use that very important fuel. The $12 million will get us those grants and those new gas station for E85.
I'm going to interrupt for just a moment. Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Garvey, to put that into context for us, how many gas stations are there in the state of Minnesota?
Well, the number seems to vary depending on who you ask, but I sort of ballpark it at just slightly under 4,000.
So this would, Mr. Garvey, this yeah. would put us at slightly less than 10.
Yes, yes. I mean, the goal is to make E85 accessible to all Minnesotans so that when they buy and use a flex fuel vehicle, they can readily fill it up with E85 fuel.
Madam Chair, Mr. Garvey, I certainly support doing that and have supported in the past what we've done to help stations, but I'm wondering at what point the market forces would take over where there are enough E85 vehicles on the road so that the stations that do not provide E85 would be at a competitive disadvantage in the market and they would be willing to put in E85 at their own expense with no state help.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Garvey.
Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson, I mean, that's a very, very important question and one that we've sort of struggled to find an answer to. We don't know the exact answer, but we know that we don't have enough now to allow market forces to do that. We know that the 300 E85 pumps that we have currently installed, I want to sort of say 99% of them receive some form of grant, $5,000 to $15,000. We know that when that money runs out, new E85 pumps don't get installed. Installing an E85 pump costs between $10,000 and $50,000, depending upon the individual gas station, its location, its actual designs, and how they want to do it. And so what we've tried to do in the past and what we intend to do with this money is to provide about a third to a quarter of that expense as an offset, as an encouragement to the individual gas station owners to do it.
Madam Chair, Mr. Garvey, if my memory is correct, we provided some funding for this program in the supplemental budget bill last spring. Do you know if that money has all been expended, all been used?
Yes, it has been expended. We have also used money within the Department of Commerce's budget to continue that program because we wanted to keep that going. And that's when we see that money dry up and you have the waiting list, they sort of say, you know. I mean, and this is, Madam Chair, if I may just sort of expand on this. The E85 fuel approach requires policies pushing on three different elements simultaneously. One of them I've talked about right here, and that is the availability / accessibility and convenience of obtaining the fuel at gas stations, more gas stations. The other is the actual purchase of and use of E85 flex-fueled vehicles. The third is making ethanol more available from an array of sources, not only from corn, but from cellulosic. And that's another portion of a part of the governor's Next Generation Energy Initiative, which you have in probably in the Department of Agriculture's budget. But those three things you need to push simultaneously: more pumps, more flex fuel vehicles, more ethanol being produced from various sources. The flex fuel vehicle approach that we're taking is A, encouraging the creation and the implementation of of conversion kits, working with the automakers and encouraging them to basically both produce and then market and make consumers aware that their vehicle is E85 capable as a flex fuel. And those three things are being we do together.
Madam Chair, Mr. Garvey, I wasn't going to ask another question, but I'm going to. Are conversion kits legal to use now?
I'm getting the big no, not yet, sir.
And where can we buy one?
Senator Frederickson,
talk to Bruce Jones at Mankato.
Senator Frederick, excuse me, I'm the chair, please.
Madam Chair,
sorry. That's okay. I just want to get in on this conversation a little bit. Senator Frederickson, are you referring to converting your car or a pump?
Yes, no.
I just want to be clear.
Madam Chair, converting a vehicle to 85. I believe there is equipment to do that. I also, it's my understanding that it's illegal to use them in the United States.
And why?
Which raises a question. You just said why.
Why? Who knows why?
Because the auto industry is not.
Sir, does someone have an answer? Mr. Knopf, do you know why?
Well, Madam Chair, I can only guess, but I think an educated guess would be that it would affect the vehicle emission control system. Generally, you can't mess around with a vehicle because of the concern over what it would do to the emission control system. Hmm. But that's I don't know that specifically in this case, but I know that there are tampering issues that tampering with the vehicle is illegal that way.
That does make sense. Commissioner Garvey, anything you want to add to that? Any more guesses?
Well, Madam Chairman, thank you very much, and I'm sorry I didn't direct my responses through you, and I'll try not to do that again. Madam Chair, members of the committee, what I was just informed is that is exactly what you were just advised, that these conversion kits need approval from the USEPA because of the Clean Air Act implications to it. We have been expressing our displeasure to that kind of issue and trying to find waiver issues with the USEPA on that. That's one of our policy efforts.
Okay, Senator Frederickson, are you?
I'm through.
Okay.
Yes.
I'll be quiet for a while.
On the ethanol, all right, are you guys want to ask about ethanol as well? Because I just want to know, well, I'll get to mine later then. Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Garvey, how are we doing with our state fleet of vehicles in terms of making them, buying vehicles that can use E85?
Mr. Garvey.
Madam Chairman, Senator Dill, under the governor's smart fleet executive order that he issued several years ago, we are in the process of gathering that information. I do not have that readily at my fingertips. I would be happy to provide it to you and the members of the committee. But if I may say, my recollection of reviewing that data is that we are improving our purchases because, A, it's the policy and requirement of the state of Minnesota, but also we think that those vehicles are good and provide good services to the state of Minnesota.
Well, didn't Senator Frederickson put that legislation into our omnibus bill last year that require all us to build up to all the state's fleet to be flexible fuel? Or it was very aggressive. I can't remember. Anyone know? Okay, we'll have to check on that. And I did buy, full disclosure, I bought my flexible fuel car at a state auction. So I have an old, I found out it was used by the DNR, and I didn't buy the ones that had the wheels covered with rust, you know, that had driven through the wetlands or the lakes of Minnesota. So it was a very interesting experience. This is at a period when my household did not have a budget surplus. So we went to an auction, and I wrote a check for it. You know, it was a pretty low budget 1998 Taurus, and it's been a great car. And so I've been, it's been an interesting experience. So trying to find those E85 pumps. And I don't think a lot of people in the city know how available it really is already in Minnesota, even in the urban areas. Anyway, Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Commissioner. Did you say in your testimony that there was a waiting list for additional grants to build pumps? Was that part of your testimony? I seem to recall you talking about that there might be some people waiting to get the grants and that this would expand the availability of grants. Did I hear that correctly?
Mr. Garvey.
Madam Chair, Senator Hamm. The way these grant programs have worked and that the way we intend them to work going forward is that the money would be funded through us in a grant to the American Lung Association. The American Lung Association then is the entity that handles the grants and works with the individual gas stations owners to figure out how much they should get. And yes, they have, as a rule, what we are told is that there are gas stations across the state that are interested in making conversions, and that interest waxes and wanes depending upon the availability of a grant.
And Senator Hamm.
Madam Chair, thank you, and Commissioner. I guess the question I have then is. If there are people that are interested in doing this, would they be interested in doing it if there wasn't a grant? In other words, if we expand the grant program, are we, in effect, putting money out to do something that people would do otherwise if the market demand for more fueling points were to be there. And so I guess I'm trying to understand how effective it is to try to manipulate or move the market, and rather than let the marketplace kind of sort out for itself how many fuel stations you need and what time they need to be there. And is there any thought about that or any concern that we might be funding something that was going to occur anyway?
Commissioner Garvey.
Madam Chair, Senator Hamm, we thought about that issue, and we thought about that issue on several fronts. First and most importantly, that's why we're not basically proposing that every gas station could and should be funded. I mean, this is a significant portion of the state's gas stations that would be eligible for these kind of grants, that funding would be available, but not all of them, because at some point you do sort of have it. Second, our understanding of why gas station owners, and most gas station owners, Minnesota has relatively few corporately owned gas stations. Most gas stations are branded operations that are owned and operated by a local operator. So this is a small business person making a decision. And they're making a decision, some of them will make a decision in just one or two reasons, some of them will have a mixture. But the reasons are, one is that they're getting asked by some of their customers, and they think that they want to meet their customers. Another set think that they just, you know, they're not, but they want to get, they recognize the goodness of this idea and want to be part of this this effort. The others is basically that they want to make money. Having said that, the selling of the fuel at a gas station is one of their least margined products. So this is a very small margin product that is. So, you know, when you ask a gas station to sort of take out a pump or replace a pump or construct a new tank to do this kind of fuel, I mean, they're not making a lot of margin on it to begin with. Their overall revenues are relatively small and tight. And so it's just enough to sort of say, yeah, this is a good idea. I can do that with the grant. And that's what we're trying to keep that momentum going, Senator.
All right. Do you know, maybe you said this before, but do you know how many stations have been built, E85 pumps, I should say, without any state assistance out of this 300?
It is, Madam Chair and members of the committee, it is my understanding that you look at the growth of both supply. I have a graph. It's in a different handout. Maybe I can sort of show it to you from a distance. Gas station owners generally have been encouraged to put in E85 pumps with the grant. I would basically argue that probably 99% of those receive some form of a grant.
Okay. And Commissioner Garvey, if we had 1,800 pumps, how much ethanol would we be selling compared to how much we're selling now in Minnesota?
Madam Chairman, I don't have that number exactly off the hand, but directly at the top, off the top of my head, but I can give you an estimation of what that number indicates. That number would indicate would be the equivalent of if we went from the E10 to the E20. Currently, we have an E10 mandate. We want to go to an E20. So 20% of our gasoline would be. We need to go through a series of EPA waiver requirements and approvals for that. At the same time, in measured in gallons, we estimate that 1,800 gas stations selling E85 at the projected levels will be about the equivalent of what it would be at an E20 approach.
Commissioner Garvey, the law already requires us to get to E20, assuming the approval comes in about the same time frame. I think it's by 2012 or something. So these will be both happening at the same time, the E85 pumps plus the E20. So then you're talking about twice as much. Is my math right there, roughly?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, ideally, yes. But I think the key component is that if we can get the waivers and if we can make that E20 work. At the same time, we think that E85 is a fuel that we want to encourage the use of because it reduces our use of petroleum.
I guess what I'm getting at is how much more ethanol are we contemplating selling in Minnesota, and you know, is there enough to even fill these pumps? How many more gallons will be produced during this time frame in Minnesota? Will we be looking at shortages of ethanol if we fill up, or will, you know, do you have any projections about how much ethanol it will take to be able to be selling them at all these stations? And can do we have the capacity?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, as I mentioned, we're pursuing this issue along three policy fronts: more pumps, more flex fuel vehicles, and more ethanol from multiple sources. We believe, and we have a strong foundation for this belief, that the supply of ethanol will not only be able to keep up with, but will exceed, because we believe that this is a fuel that not only we can produce here for Minnesota's own consumption, but we can produce it for elsewhere in the country.
Mr. Knopf's pointing out the under the E20 law that once we get 20% overall out of our total fuel mix, then that 20% blend requirement goes away. Then we go back to down to 10.
Yep.
For the oxygen.
Madam Chair, if I could just explain
it. Mr.
And
Knopf?
It would have to be by December 31st, 2010. So if the state gets to 20% by that date, then this subdivision that creates the 20% ethanol blend requirement by 2013 would expire, and you would just stay at the 10% requirement for the blend.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. And this program was through ag in the past few years, I understand. Is that program shut down then through ag, or the grant through ag? Or do they have any money left?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the E85 pump program was originally started as a U.S. Department of Energy program, which is why it came through my division. Certainly the lead agency on the ethanol production and most of the questions that I've been trying to answer to the best of my ability are best handled by Commissioner Hugesson and the staff of the Department of Agriculture. But the E85 program has been coming through us and working with the Department of Agriculture.
So you've been doing the pump program all along, is what you're saying?
Working with the, we've been sort of working in partnership. There have been some instances where money has come through us. There are some instances where the money was able to come through the Department of Agriculture, but most of the program has been handled through my staff.
Okay, and can we, so this $12 million would be spread out over 3 years?
It'd be a one, Madam Chairman, it would be a one-time appropriation to the Department of Commerce for spreading it out over the 3 years, because you can only process so many grant applications and encourage so many gas stations at any one time, and so you basically spread the money actual out in grant program in grant allocations to most likely the American Lung Association of Minnesota, since they would be the implementor of the E85 contracting.
So you think roughly a third a year would be how you
spend
it?
That's how we get there, yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. All right, we'll let you continue, I think.
Madam Chairman, the next two items are to fund a set of programs that are very important to the promotion of renewable energy in both the transportation but also the electricity programs. I will speak to first of the 25 by 25 grants. Of course, we get the phrase 25 by 25 from the governor's overarching strategic goal that he announced in his State of the State in his 2006. speech, where he has proposed that the state get 25% of all of our energy sources from renewable energy sources by the year 2025. This change item would allocate $2.5 million in each of the next 2 years of the biennium from the Renewable Development Fund to the Department of Commerce. The allocations of those monies under the governor's change item would be that $500,000 of that would be in each of the years for capital grants for methane digesters. $5,000 would be used to continue to assist in awarding grants under the state's nationally recognized solar rebate program. $500,000 of it per year would be allocated to provide community energy technical assistance and research. These are from the so-called CERTS teams, the Clean Energy Resource Teams. These are grassroots organizations that are sponsored throughout the state that pulled leaders and experts to talk about how they can promote renewable energy in their specific areas of the country. And then the balance, $1 million, will be allocated towards technical analysis and demonstration funding for automotive technology projects. That's really sort of phraseology for promotions of plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, of which I have the honor to be the vice chair of the legislative task force on how to address and overcome barriers to the production and use of plug-in hybrid electric vehicles.
Yeah, we did. I think that's a recommendation.
So, all right. I think this would probably be a good – well, let me just first start by asking these four different projects here. It looks like the solar program and the CERTS program, are those basically continuation of the same amount of funding – from the last biennium or not?
Madam Chairman, I believe the answer is that they are continuation of funding and approximately the same that they have received over the years. I'm not sure if it's exactly the same.
Okay, and the other two are new programs? What about the methane digester project?
Methane digesters, there are programs for the incentives for methane digesters. The wrinkle to that is that those funding programs are designed to help after they've been built rather than the capital to build them. And that isn't as helpful as actually providing for the capital grants. The plug-in hybrid funding is a new funding item.
Okay, I think this would be a helpful time to go through the. This is all recommended out of the Renewable Development Fund. Is that right?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Could you just give the committee some background on that? And I mean, we just heard the very beginning. I guess this was started in 1994 in the Prairie Island legislation. It was set up, and I can't remember in 2003 what we did in terms of how much money goes into it after.
We went to 16 million.
That's when we went to 16 million in 2003. So just tell the committee, if you would, where that money has gone in the last few years. And
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the Renewable Development Fund was created, as you correctly indicated, in the Prairie Island legislation as a $500,000 charge, if you would, towards Xcel for each cask of nuclear waste that they stored at the Prairie Island facility. It was not and it is not actually a formal fund in the sense of there's a pot of money sitting there to be tapped. It is more of an accounting or financial obligation on Xcel. In 2003, it became the administration became, you as legislators became aware that not a lot of funds from a lot of funds have been accrued into that, but not a lot had actually been sent because they had not formalized any mechanism for disbursement. At the same time, we were discussing, as some of you remember, the law that's applicable to dry cask storage in the state on a going forward basis. As part of the 2003 legislation, it was concluded that since they're probably going to have 32 casks at Prairie Island, if it moves to continued operation through its projected life, that at $500,000 a cask adds up to about $16,000. We would just basically take that money, move it forward, and start formalizing its disbursement. At the same time, we allocated an amount that has accrued in the Renewable Development Fund to the University of Minnesota's IRE, or Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment. That's how IRE got one of its initial funding mechanisms. Over the years, tens of millions of dollars of that money has been allocated out in grants to a whole host of projects, from demonstration projects to basic research projects to buying on the cost of very promising technologies to basic research and applied research. When the Excel gets enough money, it issues an RFP. And Madam Chairman, at this point, it might really behoove the committee to hear from the Renewable Development Governing Board, which is made up of Excel, environmental members, and community business members, and I think there's a Prairie Island representative on that. And they are much more detailed. I'll continue with my very snapshot. In addition, the legislature, in 2005, also allocated certain amounts from the Renewable Development Fund for continued payment for the small wind programs, the Renewable Energy Production Incentive, the under 2 megawatt programs. And so while that is one to sort of use, while that fund is there and is funded at $16 million, many of those programs have been, much of the funds have to some extent already been accounted for, at least for a period of time into the future.
Maybe I'll just add to that. This is a fund, there's been a lot of grants given out over the years, and I think it would be very valuable to have the board come in and go through some of those projects to give us a sense of what they've done, but it's also been subject to several raids, as you could from the legislature and the governor's office. So Commissioner Garvey mentioned a couple of those, but I just want to point out the three big ones. One is IRE that you mentioned. I think that was $10 million or $15
million. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the initial grant was for $10 million from the Renewable Development Fund. That was in a single lump sum in the summer of 2003. They also received an allocation from Xcel for $2 million for 5 years from its Xcel's energy conservation program.
Oh, that was the SIP one. Okay, gotcha. And so that one is done. The Renewable Development Fund payment is done for that. In 2003, the Mesabi Coal Plant project in northern Minnesota received a $10 million piece of that fund. I probably shouldn't say more than that. That was a very controversial item, so that's a long story. And that was a one-time, I think, correct?
Gasification.
For the coal gasification plant that's proposed on the Iron Range. And then I think it was in the last biennium, the governor proposed using some of it for to replace money for the small wind incentive. And we had a small wind incentive of a penny and a half kilowatt hour in place for a number of years that was really helpful in getting small wind projects off the ground. And after that appropriation was used up, we ultimately used some of the Renewable Development Fund dollars for that. So I guess my next question is, the Renewable Energy Production Incentive, the wind incentive, how much, we call it the REPI, I'm just saying for the new members' benefit. How much of that, is there still some of that obligation coming out of this fund for a number of years? Or are all the obligations met going forward?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no. The REPI obligations are for 10 years. So they are running for a period of time. Plus, there are specific set-asides, as I've already indicated, for some other kinds of technologies, particularly the methane digester incentive. And so you have to sort of reserve some of this funds for that. The grant to the Excelsior is $2 million over 5 years from when it was let. So that still has a couple years to run.
And members, just keep in mind, this is basically XL ratepayers that are paying this fund. And so I think it would be really helpful, and I don't know if it's in the budget book, but just to have a breakdown of all the money, where it's going now, and how much is in the fund in the now and going forward, so that we can look at this in that context.
Madam Chairman,
can you prepare that for us?
Madam Chairman, we could, but we would most likely contact the Renewable Development Fund Board for that information. So
ask them to do that.
It might be best, but we could do that for you if you wish, but it might be better to get it from the proverbial horse's mouth, ma'am.
Well, that'd be great. If you wouldn't mind requesting that on our behalf, that would be terrific. Senator Fredrickson?
Madam Chair, Mr. Garvey, I was looking at the REPI fund in the statute book, and it states that up to January of 2018, up to $10,900,000 annually is allocated to the account for renewable energy. And of that 10.9, 9.4 is for incentives for up to 200 megawatts of electricity by wind energy conversion systems. Now, we must have met that 200 megawatts quite some time ago. So I'm wondering, does this statute need to be revised, or is it still operable?
Senator Garvey.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferguson. Yeah, actually, we met that. We were able to fulfill the second 100 megawatts under that statute within weeks of its enactment. But at the same time, that statute also is the authorizing authority for the appropriation for the money from the Renewable Development Fund. So that money is now accounted for and being allocated from the fund under that statute.
And so there's still an obligation of $10 million or so every year until 2018. But there's no room left for new applicants to get into that 10-year. I mean, once you're in for 10 years, but there's a limited pot.
Correct.
So how much roughly is available out of the $16 million a year at this point? Do you know that?
Madam Chairman, there are two ways to look at the fund. One is its going concern, and one is the amount that it has accrued. Because not all of the 16, there's roughly a $2 to $4 million left of the $16 million on an annual basis. And this is where you need to I'd have to get those specific numbers, or you should hear from the Renewable Development Fund Board. But there's also money that has that number moves over a period of time, depending upon whether all the grant recipients have actually, we'll call it, been appropriated their grant. Whether the monies that have been set aside for certain technological set-asides will, in fact, use that. You need to want to set it aside, but you also have to sort of calibrate it. We estimate that as of right now, there's roughly about $29 million. If you take what's left in the fund and what would go in the $16 million contribution today, that number may be off depending on how we look at it. This is where the Renewable Development Fund Board's numbers would be more valuable. We know that the Public Utilities Commission has already suggested to Xcel and the board that they should issue an RFP for $23 million worth of grant funding.
And how much are you recommending in your whole budget of spending out of that fund, out of that $29
million? 7.5. For the 2 years of the biennium, Madam Chair.
7.5 for each year?
7.5 for each year.
So a total of 15.
2.5 for 25 by 25 grants, and then 5 per year per biennium, per year of the biennium for next generation research grants, which is the third change item that I would talk about.
Well, let's. Why don't you continue? I can.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the 25 by 25 grants are relatively small, in the sense that we want, to, but they're for specific types of programs that we want to fund and believe deserve to be funded over the next biennium. That's different, even though it's coming from the same source, for the next generation energy research. Research into renewable energy development is an important thing that we want to support and fund. What this change item is that for $5 million in the first year, $5 million in the next fiscal year, the Renewable Development Fund would give to the Department of Commerce $5 million in each of those 2 years so that we would issue grants on a competitive basis, on a cost-sharing basis, to our research institutions in the state of Minnesota, the University of Minnesota's IRE program, MinSCU, AURI, or another entities could apply on that basis. And this is our way of saying we need to do basic and applied research at our institutions of higher learning.
It's going for bio.
This is Jennifer. Okay. Is this $10 million from the RDF or the general fund?
RDF, ma'am.
Okay. Department of Ag's got another. Oh, okay. I'm hearing from Mr. Mueller that the Department of Ag has another pot that they're proposing for similar research. That's from the general fund?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Department of Agriculture is
more for grants to companies that do it, though, I think.
Funding is for cellulosic and biogasification research.
And this is for what? Particular energy applications or issues?
It would be for renewable energy. And so it could be used for a lot of different kinds of renewable energy, but it certainly would have a focus on electrical. Mm-hmm. We certainly could use it for transportation fuel replacement and those kinds of things. But in the Department of Agriculture's portion of the governor's recommendation is to promote the next generation biofuels kinds of research specifically. I mean that's what they're focusing on. This is focusing on renewable electricity generation. Doesn't mean we can't allocate it to other kinds of research if there's a worthy project and you want to do that. But that's the delineation. That's why that's being handled at the Department of Agriculture, and this is being handled by the Department of Commerce.
And these research grants, are these the similar types of grants that are these research grants similar to what the existing RDF board possibly is doing already? Or how are they different?
And actually, Assistant Commissioner Bull basically provided me some a very pertinent piece of information that actually answers both the previous question, but also that one specifically. This is money for research to give to the institutions to do research for themselves. I mean, for example, the $10 million that the Renewable Development Fund that was allocated from the Renewable to IRE. Gate went to the University of Minnesota, and then they set up their research priorities and their sets of focus, and they have a very, very extensive and very positive set of researches. the Department of Agriculture's funding was for funding of specific types of projects to develop next-generation biofuels. To your question specifically, Madam Chair, the Renewable Development Fund Board does an RFP that says we want ideas for research that we would fund or projects that we want to demonstrate and support. And there would be that they provide more specific project funding. This is more for research money that you give to IRE or that you give to Minsky or you give to AURI and have them figure out how they want to do their research within the guidelines of sort of understanding that, of what we wanted, what kind of research we'd want them to work on.
But doesn't the RDF board fund some research?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, they do fund some kinds of research, and this is one of those perfect kinds of questions that you should ask them to elaborate on. They fund three kinds of programs. They fund basic research, they fund applied research, and they will fund demonstration kinds of projects. There's always tension between those kinds of things, between whether you should be doing more demonstration projects and less basic research. We're going to try to focus here more on this setting on basic and applied research that the institutions think and we think will focus more on next generation renewable energy overall.
Well, I guess we're at a disadvantage here because we don't know what they've funded.
Yes.
And so presumably you think that what you would fund would be more valuable than what they're funding. But it's a little hard for you to convince us without having anything to compare it with. But maybe you can just answer that question. Why do you think this is a better use of those dollars? What do you think is not being done adequately using the existing mechanism?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the types of programs that are being funded here, first the 25 by 25 programs and the deep kind of research of the next generation research grants, are different kinds of programs in the sense that on one side you're focusing on basic and applied research. That's the next generation issues. The other side, we're funding programs, CERTs, the solar rebate programs, plug-in hybrid kinds of work, as opposed to issuing a request for proposals that someone says, I have this great idea that I would do if I got a grant. And any of these are less worthy. It's a different kind of application and use of the funds.
And I assume, Commissioner Garvey, that you've talked with the academic institutions. And I mean, is this something that would would they be able to come in and tell us what types of research in particular they might be looking at, what the need is greatest that needs to be funded?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, we've already touched on that. The University of Minnesota IRE funding is starting to see the end of its funding. AURI, Mankato State, or University of Minnesota at Mankato, State University of Minnesota at Mankato. I got that right? I mean, that, you know, those kinds of institutions, AURI, NRRI, those institutions are all doing valuable energy and renewable energy types of research. They're asking for and looking for and need funding support. What we're trying to do here is put in a mechanism where we can provide them some of that support within the context of the governor's Next Generation Energy Initiative program.
And just remind me, you said IRE, they got one-time money from the RDF, and then they got is that the five-year from the SIP program? Is that right?
$10 million, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
And when does that expire?
$10 million from the Renewable Development Fund was dispersed to them into July and August of 2003. They received a $2 million check, I believe, starting in that third quarter of 2003, and receive a $2 million check from Xcel for each of the subsequent 5 years. And so when you start adding that up, that means their last check comes
this year or next year.
And so, you know, so we so, like they are also sort of looking at the end of that.
Do you know if they're coming with their own proposal for new funding? I haven't had a chance to talk to them yet.
Madam Chairman, it is unclear on that point. I know that the University of Minnesota supports IRE and is looking for ways to fund it, and there are two types of fundings that they have. One is the operations of IRE itself and providing for support for the faculty and the research that they're doing, and then actual money to help individual projects continue to operate. And those are the two types of research money that I believe that they are exploring. Whether they have funding in their budget, I don't have enough details on this.
Well, we'll check with Senator Pappas about whether she has anything in her budget. Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, this will clearly be a freshman's question, and I've been trying to follow the exchange back and forth. Can I ask maybe a redundant question that might simplify it for me? I read this as a transfer from the Renewal Development Fund. Are there projects that will not be funded because of this transfer? Are we going to shift the direction of what is being funded?
Commissioner Garvey.
Madam Chairman, Senator Rummel. I think the answer to that question is found in the answer to Chairman Anderson's question. We are taking money that has not yet been obligated from the Renewable Development Fund that would be obligated if they go forward with their own request for proposals for grants. So there's not any money being taken away from anyone. It just basically sort of shifts the money from projects that would otherwise be funded under the Renewable Development Fund request for proposal process to these kinds of funding programs.
Senator Rummel?
Madam Chair, Commissioner. So as I understand it then, the governor is directing, creating a focus in one area or two areas.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Rummel, the governor is suggesting that money from the Renewable Development Fund be allocated for these purposes.
Okay, any other questions? Great, thank you. Go ahead if you have.
There are several questions you had for Dr. Haar that status of nuclear waste at
right.
Monticello.
Yes. Please.
The lawsuit and that kind of thing. Senator Frederickson, I believe you had that question. Under the 2003 Prairie Island legislation, a decision by the commission on the additional storage of dry cask nuclear waste at a nuclear facility in the state goes into effect only after the legislature has had an opportunity to review and reverse that decision. So to put that in specific context for the Monticello case, last fall, the Public Utilities Commission concluded that the Monticello facility should continue to go forward under the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission's relicensing process. To do that, they will need a dry cask storage capabilities. They granted that certificate of need to Xcel Energy for that purposes. They have sent a letter to legislative leaders at the beginning of this month, indicating that they've made that decision. That decision is not executed until the legislature adjourns in May. So there is no action, and there cannot be any action on that issue until the adjournment of this legislative session. Madam Chair, I believe the other question that was asked was the status of the lawsuits. The Xcel Energy, under order by the Public Utilities Commission and the federal government, has been contributing to large sums of money to the Yucca Mountain construction funds. Yucca Mountain is unlikely to be taking waste in any of the foreseeable future. Some would argue it will never. That Xcel is seeking recovery of the funds that they've contributed. They have won on that, but they have not been able to recover because they have to recover from the U.S. federal government the proceeds and are in special claims court in the U.S. District Court of the District of Columbia. And that case is currently being tried before a special judge in that special claims court. And it's my understanding that they've been taking depositions, and oral arguments will be scheduled sometime in the next 18 months. But these things take a long time. It's been going on for a long time.
But presumably there's a whole bunch of other utilities in other states that have the same claim.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is, I believe that that is the case. However, Xcel is the primary litigant in this particular one because they've been, they are the ones that have been under such rightful pressure to deal with the nuclear waste and move it out of the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Senator Fredrickson?
Madam Chair, Mr. Garvey, on what basis do you say that Yucca Mountain is unlikely to ever receive and store high-level nuclear waste?
Commissioner Garvey?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Fredrickson, I think the best source I have is my friend George Crocker says that, and I believe him. I think the foundation for both of our opinions are that the recent findings by the Department of Energy and the U.S. EPA in doing environmental impact statements on Yucca Mountain has found a number of long-term concerns that would need to be addressed, that I believe that the Congress has effectively limited the funding of the U.S. Department of Energy to address those concerns. I mean, so that there seems to be this sort of this, we'll call it the word strangulation comes to mind, but I don't want to use that. The sort of the withering on the vine of the development of that site.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, I'm more than a little distressed to hear that we might have high-level nuclear waste stored on the Mississippi River at two locations for the foreseeable future for possibly many generations. I hope that there gets to be a repository.
As I recall, Senator Fredrickson, you and I and some others have been arguing that for many, many years. That would be the inevitable outcome.
Madam Chair, you're right.
Senator Kubley.
Well, I think, Madam Chair, too, that, I mean, the federal repository at Yucca Mountain would be filled almost immediately upon its opening as soon as transportation could be arranged. So it does seem to me if we're generating more nuclear waste, we're going to have to live with it. You know, there wouldn't be another site forthcoming. But, Commissioner, I'd like to, were there any, do you know if the Utilities Commission attached any conditions to the storage of nuclear waste at Monticello?
I don't have that information before me, no.
Okay. And one follow-up, Madam Chair.
Is anyone from the PUC still here?
Do you know if the Utilities Commission asked that they also pay that amount into the Renewable Development Fund, even though you're saying it's not a fund? I understand that, but is the same requirement there as we had on the original cast at Prairie Island.
Yeah, Michael confirms it. It was changed from a per cast charge to a lump sum.
Per year.
Per year.
Until the plan is decommissioned.
And Madam Chairman, it would be, if you want to walk, you should hear from people who are probably better informed and closer to the nuclear waste issue. Because what I mean, I've given you my impression, but I'm not as close to that as perhaps I should. To actually give you the true picture, so I want to sort of put a caveat on that, and based upon your views and that kind of thing, that you should hear from the XL Energy, and you might want to hear from the U.S. Department of Energy on that issue before you sort of completely conclude that my words were correct.
Okay.
Have I waffled on that issue enough, Madam Chair, or backtracked?
Very well done.
Well, Commissioner,
yes,
with that kind
of,
well,
Senator Kubler.
I was just going to tell the Commissioner that with that kind of experience, you might consider running for public office.
Oh, too funny. Commissioner Garvey.
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry asked a question of Executive Secretary Brill Haar about the Big Stone. In the department's role as the both the public policy advisor to the governor and the advocate before the Public Utilities Commission, we have been we'll call it a very strong litigated party in the Big Stone in the Big Stone matter. We have expressed a number of concerns regarding that facility and the lines connected to it, that the Public Utilities Commission will have to sort it out. In addition, you'll note in the governor's Next Generation Energy Initiative bill codified that we hope will be codified, the governor has proposed that any new fossil fueled electrical generation facility needs to offset those any carbon emissions. Senator Chaudhry, while we have not been directly interfacing with the members of South Dakota and theirs, because we basically look at this as we handle what's in our jurisdiction, we've been very, very sensitive and aware of the environmental implications of that facility and are working and making recommendations to address them.
Senator Chaudhry.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thanks for bringing that up. Just for my background, what is the jurisdiction of the Commerce Department in that facility versus a facility that's built in Minnesota?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the actual focal point of the discussion is on the transmission lines from the facility. And that issue is the critical issue there is the need for those lines. Our view is that the connection of those lines to the Big Stone facility makes the generation facility a part of our public policy analysis. And so the narrow decision is going to be on a certificate of need for the wires.
Yeah.
But that issue of without the power plant, you don't need those wires. So do you need the power plant? And what are the circumstances and issues that would make that in the public's interest?
Madam Chair.
Senator Chaudhry.
If Big Stone 2 was being built within the borders, Minnesota borders, would your involvement be different?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Shetty, yes, that it would have to, it, the actual facility itself would have to go into, go through a formal certificate of need, like the, as well as the actual transmission lines.
Madam Chair,
Senator Shetty,
through the Commerce Department?
The certificate of need process is through the, well, the certificate of need is issued by the Public Utilities Commission. We provide the public, the administration's, the government's perspective to the commission on all of its dockets. So they are the quasi-judicial deciding body. We are an advocate before that body.
Senator Shetty, I want to wrap up here, so do you have many more questions? Or
just a couple quick ones.
All right, because I have some announcements before people leave. Maybe I'll do my announcements first, because I'm afraid we might run out of time. And I just wanted to respond. I know that someone had asked about the decision on Monticello casks, and I do know that there were no restrictions that the PUC put into that decision, and there was no change in the money to the casks. There was no additional money requirement for the Renewable Development Fund as a result of that decision. I don't think they talked about any conditions at all. I don't know if they were talked about, but they weren't ordered.
Okay.
I just want to make an announcement, and we could continue talking about these issues, I'm sure, for a long time. But the next committee, before members leave, next Tuesday's our normally scheduled committee, and we have we're really excited that there will be a very unusual presentation next Tuesday in lieu of our committee, and this is a joint presentation sponsored by this committee, the Energy Committee, the Environment Committee, and the Energy Committee, and the Transportation Committees in the House and Senate. So all eight of us chairs are sponsoring a presentation hearing on global warming, which will be next Tuesday at 4 o'clock in the House chamber, which is rather historic to be able to do it there. And so House and Senate members of all of these committees are, we would like you all to come and attend and be there. And we're going to make sure that there's space available for all the members of the committees. And then, as space permits, we'll allow any other legislators who want to attend, and staff as well, hopefully, if there's room, to sit in the well, we're going to let committee staff, you guys get, you can sit there for sure. We want committee and staff members to be part of this hearing. But beyond that, we'll open it up as space permits in the chamber and the galleries. So it's at 4 o'clock, and so this committee will not meet next Tuesday except for that hearing. The speakers will be Will Steger before he sets off on his next expedition, which he's doing very, very shortly. And if you haven't heard him speak before about his personal experiences traveling to the poles and seeing what's the changes that are occurring very, very rapidly there to the ice and the way of life for the indigenous people and the wildlife, it's really incredibly compelling. And then we'll have three scientists from the University of Minnesota who are all experts in their fields and have researched impacts that we can expect from climate change to the state of Minnesota and our ecosystems and our natural resources in particular. So it should be a really, really good hearing or presentation, I should say. It's not an actual committee hearing, but we really encourage you to attend. I think it'll be great. And we also want to especially thank Senator Vickerman, because we did try to schedule a time that wouldn't conflict with other committees, and, of course, that was a little bit impossible. But the only direct conflict that we're aware of for this committee was Senator Vickerman's committee, and he's agreed to end his committee early, so there won't be a conflict, and we really appreciate that. I think that's all I need to say about it. So that's the plan for next Tuesday. And I think I'll ask if members have further questions for Commissioner Garvey. If you don't mind, maybe you could continue to hang around for a couple minutes to continue those conversations, because we do need to adjourn. So I apologize for cutting you off, Senator Shetty. You can ask away.
And I see why you need more time.
Yeah, I need a little time. Yeah. So, but thank you very much, and the meeting is adjourned. Yeah, isn't that different?